Hello and welcome to The Bunker, your daily dose of news and politics. I'm Jacob Jarvis. First of all, a massive thank you to all of you who have backed us on Patreon. We've had loads of new supporters lately, and if you'd like to join them and get episodes ad-free and early, search Bunker Patreon Podcast or follow the link in the show notes. On this edition, we're going to be discussing how Joe Biden is preparing for Donald Trump to once again try to steal election victory if he loses in November. We all know what happened the last time Trump was defeated, and with that in mind, President Joe Biden and his team want to make sure they're ready for another tussle over American democracy. Adam Rawnsley, a reporter at Rolling Stone magazine, has written about the superstructure Biden is building to push back against Trump, and he joins me in the bunker to discuss what this looks like. Hello, Adam. Hope you're well.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you with us. So, to me, it seems like, to be honest, regardless of Biden's faults, which I don't doubt he might have, he's a much more sane and sensible prospect than Donald Trump. Is it really looking that tight, though, that it's not so clear that he'll win again this time out?
I try not to get into the business of making predictions because that's a very quick route to get humbled. But what we can say based on the current polling is that at the very least, both campaigns are expecting it, and representatives of both Trump and Biden campaigns said that they are expecting this to come down to single thousands, maybe tens of thousands of votes. And the polling is improving slightly for Biden at the moment, but still showing Trump is ahead. That may change as more voters wake up, but I haven't met anyone who's expecting it to be a blowout.
Before we started recording, you described it as some fuckery around 2024, saying you're deep in the weeds of that at the moment. It's part of what's going on here because of America's electoral system using the Electoral College, that there are just going to be so many options of states where Trump can really get into the weeds and get into the nitty-gritty and dispute things. It doesn't matter what the popular vote is. It's he can contest in 50 different places.
Yes, we have a uniquely dim system, Electoral College, which, you know, the person who gets the most votes does not win. The person who gets the most points, shall we say, wins. And we apportion points or Electoral College votes to states. And so it is entirely possible, and it has happened, that the person who gets the most votes does not win because of the Electoral College situation. That's why we don't call her former president Hillary Clinton. Because she was in that scenario. But, you know, on the Electoral College front, things are actually a little bit different and a little bit less vague this time around, because after Trump's attempt to undo the 2020 election, that was predicated on a kind of ridiculous reading of existing laws about the Electoral College. And since that happened, one of the first things that Democrats did after Biden won and was inaugurated was the Electoral Count Reform Act, which clarified that the shenanigans that he tried to pull on January 6th with the counting of the votes was, you know, it was already obviously illegal. And that's why he lost on a number of fronts on that. But the legislation clarified very much that, oh, yes, this is, by the way, super duper mega illegal. And it also changed a lot and tried to close a lot of barn doors on some of the other procedural trickery that he did. One of the things that Trump was very big on in 2020 was setting up these slates of false electors, which is, you know, when a state goes for a particular candidate, it's electors who are a handful of individuals representing their Electoral College votes sign and certify that this is the vote tally for this person, and we are giving our votes to that person. He set up a bunch of bogus electors who falsely claimed to be representatives of the Electoral College. And ECRA, the Electoral Count Reform Act, really put a much firmer lockdown on that kind of procedural fuckery, making sure that, you know, in a lot of states, governors have to sign to certify it and tightening up the deadlines for when they can certify it. So they can try that kind of stuff, but it is much more within the realm of this is obviously illegal and you may have to hire lawyers personally if you do this after the election.
I don't get the feeling, though, that regardless of the options being tighter for Donald Trump, that this will completely prevent him trying his luck on plenty of things. So what are the Democrats wargaming for at the moment? What are they expecting him to do to try and dodge around whatever new things they've put in his place.
So we spoke to a number of Biden campaign folks for this piece. And the one thing you get very quickly is a very emphatic statement that they're not going to essentially read out their anxieties and turn that into a playbook for the Trump campaign. That said, while I can't tell you what they are specifically wargaming, what I can do is say, you know, here are the things that they'd be stupid not to. So the landscape is a little bit different because Trump is not president. So the levers that he has, you know, that takes a lot of the executive branch stuff off the table, but it also, you know, leaves a lot of other stuff on the table. One of the things we saw in 2020 is when you lose, you know, election rules are always changing in different states, whether at large points or at small points. In 2020, what they spent a lot of effort doing was as soon as they found out that they had lost in a particular state, they would challenge whatever legislation had passed in that state immediately after the election. So they, you know, they did this in Pennsylvania. Mostly this was around the pandemic rules that allowed mail-in voting. So I would expect, and I think the Biden campaign and the DNC would be foolish not to expect litigation based on any new changes, expanding, preserving access on mail-in votes. You know, they will have a lot of grist for that mill in terms of being angry at folks, because a lot of the battleground states where this is going to come down to now have, if not unified Democratic control, but Democrats in particularly influential positions. So you have statewide in Michigan, you have, you know, Democrats from the governor to the secretary of state on down. You have Democratic governor, secretary of state in Wisconsin. One thing I should add for your British listeners is in the United States, the secretary of state is obviously at the federal level, a federal foreign policy person, the equivalent of a ministry of foreign affairs. But each state has its own secretary of state, which has nothing to do with foreign policy. And that is, generally speaking, the person who is in charge of election administration in that state. So that's a very, very important position for, you know, determining what's going to happen on an election. Same in Arizona, you have Democratic governor, Democratic attorney general, and you have a Democratic secretary of state, Adrian Fontes, there. It's a little bit different in Georgia, where you have a Republican secretary of state, Brad Raffensperger, who Trump tried to shake down for a few thousand votes. So the Trump campaign will have, you know, plenty of essentially bad guy targets who they're going to try and sue if things go south. And I would expect that they would pay a lot of attention to that. And, you know, the other thing that I think is one of the probably the most important things they could be doing now is what is referred to in the United States as voter protection, which is preventing Republican-controlled counties or states from interfering, intimidating, suppressing the vote in some way. Swin and I have been working on a feature about Georgia for the magazine. And one of the new features in Georgia is SB 202, which passed after the 2020 election, allows anyone in Georgia to file an unlimited number of challenges to any voter's eligibility. So some random person in your county can say, I don't believe you, Adam Ronsley, are eligible to vote. And so I'm going to challenge you based on, you know, a lot of times it's just random screenshots from websites that may or may not have outdated registration information. And then within 10 days, counties have to send out a challenge letter letting them know that, you know, there's a hearing schedule for this. Here's the basis for this challenge. And it's kind of a giant mess because the people who are doing this are very conservative, very pro-Trump activists, and they're sending out thousands upon thousands, and they're filing them, generally speaking, in Democratic or purplish counties, and they're filing them in such a way is that they're targeting, you know, minorities, essentially. I guess the reasoning there is that they're more likely to be Democrats, so let's challenge their eligibility. But that's a huge thing, and counties get overwhelmed trying to deal with these challenges, and right now there's some pending legislation in Georgia saying that, well, maybe we'll try and put a quiet period around this and say that, well, you can't do this 45 days before an election. We don't know if that's going to get signed into law yet, but that's another kind of thing that they would be fools not to be preparing for. There's all kinds of, you know, I think a lot of it would be taking place in the courtroom, essentially. And that's, you know, one of the things we mentioned in the piece was that they're just going on a hiring spree when it comes to lawyers.
Does what's going on in the American election scare and bemuse you in equal measure?
Want to know what Biden and Trump are up to without tearing your hair out?
Then you need to listen to American Friction, the brand new podcast about the countdown to the big vote in November from the makers of Oh God, What Now?, The Bunker, and Paper Cuts.
Every Friday, we'll speak to leading experts and blockbuster commentators from the United States to explain the latest news and the big issues behind the vote.
That's American Friction with me, Jacob Jarvis.
Me, Chris Jones.
And me, Nikki McCann Ramirez.
Out every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Is Biden a little bit trapped in some ways by his whole desire to go down the when they go low, we go high route of things, which has been a bit of his ethos? But clearly last time out, when Trump had more of the cards in his hand, he tried to shape things to make them go his way. And Biden doesn't seem like the sort of person who wants to do that. But in some ways, would he be best suited to go, hey, well, I have secretary of states in these places. I have much more statewide control. Fuck it. They would do the exact same thing back. So I'm going to go down that route. Is that, or is that just, I suppose, the conundrum of the sort of liberal versus illiberal situation?
Yeah, I think it's that. I mean, at a lighter level, you see this really play out when it comes to redistricting, which is a thing that happens in the United States. You know, populations change. If a state gets more people, it has to get another congressional district. One of the reasons that the Democrats lost control of the House is because they lost a lot of seats in the New York delegation, which is normally a lot more reliable of a Democratic state. But you see this as kind of an even cat and mouse game when it comes to redistricting, is you know, you draw districts along very, very partisan lines to try and ensure that that district will be, you know, reliably blue or red. Republicans have done a great job of that. And I think you're starting to see, at least in at the state level in New York, you saw them try and do redistricting on a very sort of partisan gerrymandering basis. When it comes to the more Trump-style stuff, temperamentally, Biden does not seem inclined towards that, but also just from sort of a cold political calculus, the election denial stuff is such a loser for Trump politically. One of the most interesting things that came out of the 2022 midterms is that you saw Republican secretaries of state who had engaged in big lie stuff. So like folks like Mark Fincham in Arizona actually ran behind the gubernatorial candidates. So, you know, you're voting on a ballot with all these candidates and, you know, people who were willing to vote for Carrie Lake, who is kind of a big lie person herself, were not willing to vote for Mark Fincham. And they went for a Democrat or they went for somebody else, which suggests that, you know, even among the Republican voters who are inclined towards MAGA candidates, the big lie stuff and the, you know, the sort of election, you know, fuckery stuff, for lack of a better term, it doesn't really pull that well. And so I think from, you know, temperamentally, he's disinclined towards it. I think it would cause a lot of issues within the Democratic base because you have all these people, a lot of the Democratic base is, or at least at the activist level, or people who worked in voter protection, people who worked against this kind of stuff. It would be a headache towards very little gain for the Democrats, I think.
So Biden is almost making a gamble that honesty is going to be the best policy for him, essentially, and that hopefully the electorate will go alongside that. Okay, so you said they're on this hiring spree at the moment. Do you have a sense of how big that looks? And also, I suppose, just how expensive is this? It feels like a big thing to be wasting time on, unfortunately, because a lot of time and energy has been wasted just on Donald Trump being Donald Trump.
Yes. The good news for the Biden campaign and the bad news for the Trump campaign is the same thing, essentially money. Biden is doing very well when it comes to fundraising. So the trade-offs in terms of finances aren't as severe. I think you'd see a lot more complaints and hand-wringing on that if they had to be more judicious with how they spend a more limited pile of dollars. So, I mean, the hiring spree was described to us as almost comically large. Like, they have spent millions of dollars in voter protection stuff already. You know, you need lots of lawyers, but in each state, generally speaking, there's people who are willing to step forward and do election legislation. And then there's these sort of small inner core of people in each state who, and you know, you can, if you go through all the pleadings and all the cases, you get a sense of who the main dramatis personae are. And so, you know, when it comes to elections, a lot of this stuff, you want to get it locked down beforehand, because the last thing you want to start doing is finding yourself, as soon as there's a sort of batty Trump case in front of a judge, trying to scramble and figure out, okay, who's actually good in this state, this kind of thing. The bad news for the Trump campaign in general is that if you look at the RNC's fundraising numbers and if you look at their cash on hand numbers, they're in a sub-ideal spot, which is kind of where Trump is. Trump's own fundraising is starting to pick up a little bit. But I think the DNC is in a much better position financially to start preparing for this stuff. And if you look at 2020, where the Biden campaign was at this point, you know, they were wargaming this stuff well in advance of 2020, as Trump's rhetoric on, oh, it's going to be a stolen election, was heating up. So it's a little bit muscle memory in that sense, and that they're doing the same thing they did in 2020.
Is that a part of the reason that the polls are so stagnant, because both candidates are just doing exactly what they did in 2020? Biden just seems to me to be going, hey, look, I'm clearly more sensible and the least worst option. And Trump is doing the whole, hey, QAnon people, look how crazy and conspiratorial this all is, and they've stolen it from me. And it just feels exactly the same. It's like they're playing out arguments which have been entirely played out.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I hate to say it because it's like the dumb cable news pundit, like low-hanging fruit aphorism that it's going to all come down to turnout. But it is very much that, in the sense that the one message we keep seeing from the polls is no one is excited for this race. Democrats obviously are not a huge fan of Trump, but a lot of the Republicans, moderates, and independents who maybe voted for Trump the first time, didn't want to do it, nobody's super excited for this. And you see that showing up. And I think that's why, you know, the silly aphorism, it's all going to come down to turnout, matters a lot, because who knows how many people are actually going to show up. But a lot of this is about getting people excited to actually do the work of showing up for the election. And I just don't know how that plays out. Obviously, Trump has his own sort of core fanatical base. I don't think that core is necessarily the 50% he needs. He needs at least some people who aren't like diehard MAGA hat wearing people to come over. And I think the Biden campaign, to the extent they can be successful, will probably come down to two factors. Number one, negative partisanship, essentially people who aren't necessarily tattooing Joe Biden 2024 on the inside of their eyelids, but absolutely hate Trump with the fire of a thousand suns. And so that'll get them to show up. And the second thing that I think they're hoping will drag them across the finish line is abortion, which is the big game changer. And now we see in a lot of battleground states, there is either a referendum on abortion rights, or there is a candidate in North Carolina for governor who's just, you know, so wacky on a lot of issues, abortion included, that might be an issue that, you know, freaks women out, who tend to be the ones who disproportionately show up to the polls so much that they essentially drag him across the finish line when they're going through their ballot and saying, this guy, that guy, this ballot referendum, oh, by the way, yeah, while I'm filling this out, not going to go for the guy who stacked the Supreme Court with people who overturned Roe v. Wade.
Procedurally, Trump can't do January 6th again, as you mentioned, due to, by virtue of him, you know, not being president anymore. But could you see that style of violence happening again? Could we see that sort of unrest happen again? Or perhaps even before, I don't know, Trump's in court as we record at the moment. If he were to actually be imprisoned, yes, would that lead to something else like that happening?
So the interesting thing, the sort of knock-on effect that you see from January 6th is the movement in a lot of smaller ways that are notable, nonetheless ate itself and has been kind of a victim of its own propaganda. Is, you know, as with anything that's deeply unpopular and awful, they go through the sort of PR grief cycle of trying to get away from it. And, you know, they vacillate between, well, January 6th was awesome, but also it was actually a Fed plot. And the sort of propaganda that they're using to explain it away and not portray it for what it is, which is the logical conclusion of, you know, Trump's lies, is to try and cast this as a conspiracy by the deep state seeded by Fed instigators. And I think that plus the fact that you have so many people going to jail over this and getting arrested and getting found out, I think that has created a lot of a climate of fear and uncertainty and doubt. And that does not lend itself to coordinated mass action at the Capitol. I think, you know, knock on wood, I don't think a January 6th part two would look like January 6th part one. In other words, there's not going to be the high drama at the Congress, because unlike with Mike Pence, where there's sort of this question of will he, won't he, nobody thinks that Kamala Harris is going to do this. You have to realize is that after everybody got rightfully dragged for the lack of police protection around the Capitol, you know, regardless of what happens, the Capitol is basically going to be a fortress in 2025 when they do, because it'll be January, when they do the county electoral votes. I think to the extent there's violence, my anxieties would be focused more at the state level, at sort of lesser maybe state houses, maybe polling places. The one thing that people just don't really appreciate enough that we've been doing stories about, we did it about Colorado Secretary of State Jenna Griswold, who filed the case at the Supreme Court trying to disqualify Trump from the ballot over insurrection grounds. We spoke to Adrian Fontes for an interview about Arizona, which is kind of where the worst of it is in terms of threats. But like the daily fire hose of threats against election officials is staggering. It is absolutely staggering. The Justice Department has had to create its own election threats task force. And, you know, I do hope I'm wrong that nothing happens, but I do worry about what the rising tide of threats portends.
Well, Adam, let's hope for the case that sanity prevails throughout all of this. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
And listeners, thank you so much for joining us in the bunker. If you enjoy what we do and want to hear more insight from people such as Adam, please remember you can support us on Patreon. Search Bunker Patreon Podcast or follow the link in the show notes so you can get episodes ad-free and early. I'm Jacob Jarvis. Thank you for listening to The Bunker.
Hello, I'm Dorian Lynskey.
And I'm Ian Dunn.
We are the hosts of Origin Story, the podcast that unpacks the history behind the ideas, the people and the events that shape political discourse today.
And we are back for season 5.
We're kicking off with a two-parter on George Orwell, the man, the work, the ideas. We follow him from Burma to Spain, through Second World War London, to the writing of his masterpieces Animal Farm and 1984, and how their legacy is used and misused today.
That's Origin Story Season 5, coming now from anywhere you get your podcasts.
The Bunker USA was written and presented by Podmasters Managing Editor Jacob Jarvis. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The group editor is Andrew Harrison, music is by Kenny Dickinson, and artwork is by James Parrott. The Bunker USA is a Podmasters production.